This is Terry Gibson, October 25th, 1991. Cinema and Spirituality.
Finished the experience, went out, and within an hour I got in a traffic wreck. Within an hour. Slick, wet streets, and I was paying a lot of attention. We came around this corner, and it was a pileup, and we drove right into it. And my mother was sitting right next to me. And I think it was some kind of psychic initiatory violation that I entered the wrong way into this initiatory cave with the wrong person. It was a really interesting kind of experience. But the first of those initiatory caves were the first cinema house. They were the first movie house. And I think cinema has that deep archetypal pull for us. I think the minute you go in those caves, you regress back to early life, and it's almost like the breast again, these early divine images. You ever have the experience of going into cinema, these larger-than-life figures? You tilt your head back, and I think we almost go into a trance and regress and become like little children again, filled with kind of renewing image and transformative possibility. The problem is that most of us don't know that we're going to a sacred space when we go to cinema house. We think we're going there for entertainment. And we don't consciously, we're not consciously moved and transformed by the experience. At least the flattening of our culture, the culture is trying to cut off any overt connections to the sacred. This man said something kind of interesting. A lot of the old movie houses in Kansas City, where I grew up, and small, a lot of the cinema houses were in old vaudeville houses, often in old Masonic lodges that had been transformed, or in special Baroque buildings. And you've seen that the only place in town that I know that reproduces that experience now is the Egyptian Theater, close to Seattle View, which is in an old Masonic temple, and you've got these that's a perfect place to see film. It has that same sense of temple and sacred grandeur. And we've also, and I think we know, a lot of these cinema houses now are flat, they're carpeted, plastic, linoleum-tiled floors. Anything we can do to cut off that overt connection, this is maybe something more meaningful than just going for entertainment. But first thing I just want to say is that it's a vehicle for, it's really a genuinely spiritual experience. And the film is the fundamental communicator, educator, and translator of living myth in our culture. That all of the ancient mythic images are there intact in film. When we come back, I'm going to show a vignette out of a modern science fiction film that's as mythic as anything I think could be. Why don't we take about a 10-minute break? What time? Sure, somebody. Film is a crucial medium of initiatory ritual and transformative experience, one of the few truly viable such precincts left to us. And I've been alluding to that pretty regularly. Film is living soul experience and therefore needs to be read gnostically, alchemically, mythically, and mystically. It requires profound devotional literacy in these areas. I think the more that you know, as Jung said, the more we read some of these medieval mystics and alchemists who were specialists. They went into the inner cinema of their own psyche and let those images work. The more that you're literate about that, the more sense and more conscious appreciation you have for film. I don't know how we can really appreciate particularly Bergman or Fellini without understanding the medieval alchemy. Their whole films are full of those kind of Gnostic and alchemical and mystical images. Film is the key holder of paradox and the opposites. All outer world film, no matter how grade B or trivial, has inner significance. I really believe that's true. I don't think there's any such thing as junk film. Everything that happens, happens on the unconscious and is meaningful. And all inner world film, no matter how self-absorbed, has outer world implications. Even interiors had something worthwhile when I thought about it for my outer life. I had to work for it, but it was there. Film, most of all, is the respectful teller of story and the lover of mystery. And all great art and religious experience, most of all, has been story from the great precincts of Aloysius on earth. And film is not a representation of the transcendent function, which John Beebe says it is, but a vehicle for individuation, for spiritual direction, for educating ego to recognize the transcendent function and the visions of the self that relays and portrays. And we're going to see a film. That last sentence, what do you think about that? Basically, put a diagram up here. My image of Jung. You know, contemporary analysts, drawing from Edward Ettinger primarily, who has spent the most time talking about this concept, talks about what we do in analysis is we take human beings that come in this culture preoccupied with ego, down in Pierce County, I call it the Tacoma Mall Complex. Anything that's worth having or any solution to life's pains could be found in the Tacoma Mall on Saturday afternoon. And a lot of people believe that. I mean, a lot of people believe you get depressed, you go shop and buy, get a new car, get a new stereo. More power, more money, more prestige, kind of a fascination with celebrity, kind of a complex about, you know, increasingly we're an image where our significant people are all image and no substance, an image in not the full archetypal sense, but image in just in terms of persona. A week ago Saturday, we saw a horrifying example of what our senators have become. You know, it was terrifying to me how empty the supposed wise people of our culture are supposed to be, how little real soul content is accessible to them. That was what was stunning to me. The only real soul that was possessed, if anybody possessed, was Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas. They were the only people that showed any kind of soul. Everybody else was empty and bereft. And that was tragic to me. I mean, that was the worst part of that experience. That's what happens to a culture preoccupied with ego experience and persona, with no connection to the soul. Can you imagine, for instance, what it would have been like for Ted Kennedy, for instance, to give you an idea about how the self, because analysis talks about the self getting connected to the ego and manifesting. And I think the real product of all analysis and all experiences of film is the production of compassion, compassio, the ability to be self-forgiving for my own wounds and in touch with my own inner pain. The clack phrase now, to get in touch with my lost inner child, but in a depth sense. So that I then can really be touched and not turn away from the horror of pain and suffering in other people. Compassion literally means the ability to co-suffer with other folks. I think the highest hallmark of an individuated person is their ability to be compassionate about themselves and the world around them. That's why I think we're here. I think that's all of our collective destiny, is the development of compassion. And what it would have been like for Ted Kennedy, for instance, in the middle of that horrible morass, to say, you know, I take the mic and say, you know, I want to talk for a minute. I'm aware of how abusive I have been as a man in our culture and how ashamed I am of that. An innocent woman died because I was drunk one night and I was involved in out-of-boundary experiences of my eros that were mutilating of myself and those that I loved. I've recently been involved in another experience where a woman was raped and defiled within the precincts of my own home. And I think of all of the women that I have unconsciously harassed in a patriarchal culture, and I'm ashamed. And my sense is that all nine of my colleagues here, that they would really feel it, have the same shame. And we're in a culture where the patriarchy is out of control, and I feel deep grief about that, and I just want to say I'm sorry. And I think that's a real issue here. No.
Did.
Really? That really happened. That really happened today. I didn't. Well, feel the power then. You see how the ego gets connected to the self. Yeah. But if it had happened, it happens in that kind of context, and that's what I'm talking about. How ego and Jungian analysis simply says, provides the opportunity. Jung provided an opportunity by reclaiming. Well, basically, we're a Christian, Judeo-Christian culture, and we're highly Protestant in our values. And the Protestant Reformation, in its reaction to the Roman Church, threw out all of these mystical and alchemical and spiritual directive ideas. And Jung recovered them. Jung discovered in his patients they were having 15th century Gnostic and alchemical dreams. He said, how could this be? He got excited about the correlation that there is in our personal unconscious and in our archetypal unconscious images that take us back to the divine, the imago Dei, the image of God that lives in all of us, the divine scintilla, the splinter of divine light that's in all of us. And ego, the only way ego doesn't die in this world is that it gets connected to that self. And so Jungians talk about the goal of Jungian analysis is to create an ego-self axis. Individuation helps me get in touch with the self that lives in me. That source of compassion and genuine loving engagement with myself and the world around me. The thing that those nine men were incapable of doing a week ago Saturday. And that whole event would have been turned around if just one person stood up and told the truth. Could have been anybody in the room. Just one person. And obviously only one person was telling the truth. I mean, a lot of us probably believe in even Hill was telling the truth. Possibly. I mean, we all have strong feelings. I mean, we've all got a complex. You know, that thing fired. That's why we watched all weekend. We were in a national complex. And we all talked at work. My wife and I were talking about all the ways that we sexually abuse our employees. That we, you know, it was really valuable and sometimes a kind of confession. I don't. You couldn't watch that without feeling driven to be confessional. All of us about the way that we abuse each other as a defensive reaction against our own inner pain. But my model, what film does, is it's a way to help the individuation process. Film provides us a way. When film really works, when a real auteur, a real John Ford, or a Liliana Caravani, or a Lena Wertmuller, or Howard Hawks, or Woody Allen, really grabs the images and moves themselves through their suffering and is appreciative of our suffering and the culture, the film takes us to the self, takes us to the altar of the self and provides us an opportunity for transformational connection. And these caves where we're compelled to go with a bunch of strangers in the dark and look at these bigger-than-life images that we paint on the walls of our modern caves. Even in our metro cinemas where we've taken away the gargoyles and the art and the stained glass. So, with those tenets, I'm going to show a piece. Why don't you just think film sacramental, it's mythic, it's spiritual, it connects the ego to the self. It's one of the most powerful sacramental sources we have. And it takes us to the core of our primal wound. One of the things that modern psychotherapy is discovering is that all of us were badly mauled. None of us were lucky enough to get past about 18 months, probably. Not anybody in this room probably got past 18 months with having a scar cut in their soul that we're bleeding from the rest of our life. Because our parents are human, and they broke down under the pressure, and they just couldn't unconditionally love us because of their own anxiety to living in this crazy culture. At some point, they wounded us and got sadistic with us. I don't think they intended it, but we're going to be working it out with it for the rest of our life, and then we turn around and wound our own kids. We wound the next generation. I'm going to show you a film vignette in science fiction about that early wound and the terror of it. Alien, 1979, Ridley Scott. Where you'll open is, if you remember the scene, it was quite interesting, the spaceship going through space. Do you remember that, Alien? And it opens, this celestial, it's a mandala, it's a half mandala to begin. The self is there to begin. You see the ship going around this mandala thing, mechanical. And you go inside, Ridley Scott, he's shown it's not a shiny Star Wars ship. It's kind of a depressed ship, the way it probably really will be. Dust and old dirty coffee cups. Just like our workplaces. I mean, it's a real place, it's a working place of ego. But there's no life. The camera carefully pans inside the ship. There's nobody alive. All the stations are empty. And then it goes into the center of this kind of metallic womb. And there you see the crew. They are in glass cages with diapers on. You remember? They are in deep sleep or super sleep. But they're regressed. Clearly, they're regressed. They're even unconscious. Film tells us right off, we're in the unconscious, folks. No doubt about that. And we're back in the child unconscious, way back then. You remember then, there's this, all of the ship lights turn up and these lids lift off. These incubators, these baby incubators, adults in diapers. It's a wonderful image. And the crew wakes up in this hypersleep. And they discover to their disgust, Ridley Scott has all this dialogue and it's mumbling. People hated the film because it's like real life. You just get snippets and then it's tantalizing and you hear the word like sex or intercourse or cheap money or I hate the Hispanics. You get these provocative things and you want to lean into the gossip. And it gets all garbled. That's the way life is. Riding on a city bus or train, you hear something juicy and you try to get more and it's gone. Or in a restaurant. We're all voyeurs. And Ridley Scott capitalizes on our voyeurism. We're voyeurs. We want to see somebody else's psychic pain and then say, it's not me. And there's management labor disputes going on. Pretty realistic, by the way, it's going to be. And then he discovered Dallas is daddy here, Captain Dallas. Tom Skerritt, a younger Tom Skerritt, is daddy. I mean, Tom Skerritt is a perfect... We all wished we had a dad like Tom Skerritt. I mean, he evokes this. What you find out is that the company is anonymous. We all work for this objective. Has woken them up halfway through their journey back, because they got an emergency signal from this planet. And they wanted to go and check it out. So they land, and a lot of crunching and grinding, and it's an old ship, and it's a company ship, and they're not maintained. It's like the Washington State Ferry is not very well maintained. And cracks, and they've got a leak in the hull, and the union guys say, we're not going to work unless you give us 12% more. I mean, there's this labor battle going on with management, and they're going to die if they don't fix this leak in the hull. But they all work that out. And they're going to send out a party with Captain Dallas. They're going to go out and find out where the signal's coming. And they're in this foreign environment, toxic stuff, toxic environment, blowing, it's pure nitrogen and bad wind, and there's pieces of rock blowing around. Really is like the psychoid stuff blowing around in us, that repressed, personal unconscious pain from way back there, that alien environment we never want to leave it again. When we were little kids and we discovered our parents are betraying us, and we're all alone, and we're probably in a terrible environment. We're going to die unless we get a space suit, which is a persona we'll wear the rest of our life, so we don't breathe all this toxin. And the film opens as they're entering this ancient ship that is getting off this emergency signal. Families, when we were about 18 months old. One day, our parents were having a bad day. We were a little kid playing around inside. Did you hear all the language there? Mother is the computer. Ego, typical male, patriarchal ego, you know. But I went out there and tell them there's a warning. The feminine voice is out there. Hey, I notice there's a warning, you guys. There's a warning. By the time I get out there and the time I tell them, they'll be on their way back anyway. Nothing to worry about. Those nine guys in the Judiciary Committee. Business as usual. There's no warning. But by the time we deal with this problem, it'll be solved anyway. Let's look good for the cameras and let it pass and yawn. These guys are in it. Did you see the fossil? They said the life form fossilized in the chair. What did it look masculine or feminine to you? It looked very masculine to me. It almost looked like the dead Fisher King to me. He's sitting there, his illness blown right out of his flesh. Fisher King in the Grail legend had a wound in his thigh. Wounded, dead. And they're about ready to go. Somebody said, my God, let's get out of here. It's awesome. And always somebody sees another hole. Goes down a little lower. Can't resist. We can't resist when we're little kids. We're so innocent, so curious. Goes down into this. What did he call it? It's a cave. An initiatory place. And he talks about caves. Goes into this cave, and it's a giant incubatorium. There was life forms all around. Going into the belly of the whale, going into the unconscious, like entering an elephant. And then this thing comes alive, opens up, and gets a little too curious, pushes mom or dad's buttons a little bit too far, meets dad on a bad day, meets mom on a bad day, right for the face. Which is where we want our infants, that's where we see the thing. And what it is, the rest of that's really interesting, it goes inside. They think the guy's dead. Thing won't leave go of his face. And after getting back to ship, and they peel it off. And at dinner, apparently, he's okay. They get it pulled away, kind of like a leech, interstellar leech. They pull it away, and the guy's okay. And then he looks a little groggy at dinner. He's acting a little funny. And then right out of his chest, this thing just bursts out. And then runs away. You don't get a real good look at it. It's just horrifying and dreadful and unconscious and archaic and alive and deadly. And it vanishes inside the ship, and the guy's dead. Blows a hole up through the guy's flesh. Now, in analysis, what we deal with. Unions have been very interested in the last 20... Unions and Freudians are talking to each other again, by the way. And the bridge is object relations, and it's women. Women always get men together. They can't talk in our culture. It's a duty in there. And Melanie Klein and Anna Freud and others had to figure out how to help people talk to men. And Melanie Klein, Margaret Mahler, They talk about how all of us in early life, when we get around our parents and we get in the cave of their unconscious and their unfinished process and their complexes, and we look at the little baby terror that they've got cooking in there. One day it grabs us and it goes right into us, and we call those introjects. And they're deadly, and we split them off, and they're there the rest of our life. And then people come into therapy because they can't bear to live with those introjects anymore. That split off, they have these rages at work. They've been married 5 times and can't have intimacy. They find themselves sexually or physically abusing their children. They find themselves suicidal, and it's like this other person takes them over. It's that living, mythic substance, that unfinished, unindividuated process that we pass on from generation to generation. And the only healing is when we can consciously enter it in community. This whole film, is the hero is the woman, Sigourney Weaver. She's the one that's left alive at the end. And it's a process of her individuation and facing these alien introjects that are lost in the mothership. And it's really a story about the courage of the analytic process, the process towards consciousness, the terror that we have to live with, and the courage it takes to make real souls in this world. Everybody just thought that was a science fiction film, and it was kind of a scary thing that went home. It's a profound film. Ridley Scott was another auteur, had a real sense. You can feel the power of his personality to really frame in the film. Let's close. Just wanted to quote a closing thing from a medieval mystical text that was a favorite of Jung's, a guy named, by the name of Bernard of Clairvaux, wrote a text on the Song of Song. Really wrote a poem 2,000 years ago to Sigourney Weaver, kind of help her when she was walking around inside Mother, an interstellar experience. And what Bernard of Clairvaux found out in one movie that was playing in his head one night, he met this woman, and she told him these things. You must turn your experience inwards, that intimate experience, a sealed fountain, a hidden manna where this woman of the Song of Song sings a song which cannot be heard except by those who know it. She sings a song that does not resound abroad, but is the very music of the heart, not a trilling on the lips, but an inward rock and roll pulsing of delight. Only the singer hears, and the one to whom they sing, the lover and the beloved. The fruit of the self at the end of that terrifying journey. I'm going to stop here. Those that need to go, I'd be happy to answer a few questions. Feel free to get up and leave. The rock and roll band started. Oh, tomorrow, people want to know. Let me show you what I'm going to do tomorrow. I'll show you the outline. Ingmar Bergman is a kind of a film theologian. John Beebe has a film called Film in the a cassette tape, Film in the Unconscious, from the Los Angeles Jung Institute. It's a really nice talk he gave there about 10 years ago. It's a cassette tape. Clark Branson has written a book called Howard Hawks, A Jungian Study. He's clearly not analytically trained, and he has a naive appreciation of the analytic literature and Jungian literature. But he makes a stab at Howard Hawks as an auteur and kind of looks at him from some Jungian archetypal perspectives. And it's a beginning. It's not a great book, but it's a beginning. Louise Mahdi, who has this really nice edited thing a lot of you've seen, Betwixt and Between, Open Court Press came out with. The back of that book, which may even be part of the bookseller's thing here, it's a collection of Jungian analysts and others writing about initiatory experience across the life cycle. There is a filmography section in there. People talk about initiatory film, and it's a really nice selection. Jung doesn't write overtly about film, but where you can get some look at that, the structure and dynamics of the psyche, volume 8, where he talks about the transcendent function. Some important stuff there to think about film as a healing of the opposite. In volume 15, his The Spirit in Man, Art, and Literature, a lot of his reflections about art are directly germane to film. And there's a really nice book by Annette Kuhn, for some of you interested, Women in Film, which is a real nice survey about recent experiences of women in film. Peter Malone, again, another theological book on movie Christs. It's a nice objective look at Christological symbolism in modern film. Paul Monaco's got a book on kind of social commentary and history in film. Psychological Perspectives, a journal, regular house journal of the Los Angeles Jung Institute, frequently has film reviews that are quite good and provocative. San Francisco Library Journal, John Beebe's written a number of provocative essays in the San Francisco Library Journal. Paul Schrader, I'll be talking about him tomorrow, has a really nice book, The Transcendent in Film, He looks at the work of Carl Dreyer, a Japanese director by the name of Uzo, and Robert Bresson. And it's really nice. It was one of the best books I've seen on relating psychology and spirituality. June Singer's Boundaries of the Soul, I think, would be real relevant in its overview of Jungian psychology to think about archetypal images in film. And for those of you that are interested in the theological side, Theology Today is one of the best journals that has regular film reviews in it. So those are some areas where you can go and have some chance to link up spirituality, cinema, and Jungian thought. Any other kind of quick question? The question was, do I make a distinction between film and television and film shown on television? And I do. Although my sense is that all of that is archetypal. My wife is just, I drive her nuts. I come home and we've got, you know, those cable things, 35 stations, and you kind of, I go home and my way of relaxing before I go to bed at night is to spend 40 minutes flicking the dial back and forth. She can't stand to stay in the same image with me. But I think image is always coming out of the unconscious and is always trying to urge us towards individuation, even in the most banal TV sitcom. But I think film, there's something archetypal about that 2 hours, 2 hours and 10 minutes. There's something about that time limit. Feels almost like, you know, I've been told that the Mass and some of the best Judaic rites and rites in the East often happen around a kind of a natural period of maybe 2 to 3 hours where you go through. There's this natural sequence in consciousness about every 90 minutes. When we're asleep, we go in and out of REM. And when we're conscious, we go in and out of the when we're awake, there are about 90-minute diphasic periods where we go in, dip in the unconscious. Albert Einstein used to take a nap every 90 minutes. He called it, he'd been like dozing. He'd wake up and say, I've been dozing. He'd look kind of embarrassed. And then he'd solve a mathematical problem and furiously scratch. It's like he went into the unconscious, got some renewal, and then solved the problem. And a lot of good liturgical experiences seem to take advantage of that cycle, kind of loop us through a couple times. And I've been fascinated about that 2 hour, 2 hour and 10 minute. That's, you notice the big epics that go longer than that, they very rarely work when they try films push 2 hours and 45 minutes, 3 hours. They very rarely work. There's something archetypal about that. So I think some of the shorter things in television is that if they can't ever approach the unconscious, we're such a manic and anxious culture, it makes sure that it won't really grab us and have any profound effect. It's too brief. It's kind of like a bee sting. It bites us and then it moves on. It's just not long enough to have impact. Then we break it up with commercials. The ego keeps interrupting the experience with the self. In a cinema, in a theater, we don't do that. Although I've noticed now, very disconcerting, advertising is moving into the cinema house. A lot of times you'll pay money, sit down, and instead of the cartoons, which is always kind of interesting, it's almost like the tricksters. If you've been to some of the desert Southwest and the Native American ceremonials, the kachinas come first, the clown. We go to film, it used to be the cartoons, and it was a nice massaging of the unconscious and getting us ready for image in the ear reel. But now you go and you get advertisements. There's Subaru advertisements and American Express. Have you gone to some of the American Express? You pay money to have them advertised. Watching TV, I'm glad you mentioned that. Another thing I don't like about it is that chopped framed experience. And films are made to be seen larger than life in a cave-like atmosphere with strangers. There's something archetypal about that. And please, every chance you get, go and even films that you've seen on TV that move you, go back and see them in the cinema. It's a much different experience, the way they're framed, and the whole reality of being in this dark, cavern-like structure with these images coming in. Much different. And I think that's a primary thing for me about TV. It's contained, it's safe, and it's on this chopped frame inside our and it's more human scale instead of archetypal scale. A good movie house is archetypal scale. I love the Egyptian theater in this town. I mean, the civilization, being able to have a good latte and go in the dark and sit among all the sculptures. And then I saw, if you haven't seen Barton Fink, the Coen brothers, it's a marvelous trip into the unconscious. And part of the power is being these bizarre, strange cone images coming at you and this larger-than-life screen in this dark, cavern-like space. It will not be the same experience when it comes out on video. It just won't. Any other kind of quick question? Yeah, I'm going to show you another one tomorrow too. We're going to look at a little segment out of The Grifters, some nice little incest stuff. But I noticed when I watched, it's just out on video, it had none of the same impact. One of the few films I've seen in the last 10 years where people got so viscerally upset they went out bellowing in pain and disgust after the film. It really touched something. But I watched it on videotape and it softens the blow. It's just not the same experience as seeing it in the cinema. Inventive and alive. Eros, the old Greek word for the psyche being alive in us, there's an erotic connection to the material. Eros and passion is there. Searchers has, did it have all three of those qualities? Clearly a fine technological command. John Wayne is one of his best roles. He was excellent in that. There's a real sense of technological mastery drawn out of the actors and the space and the frame. You have a real sense of the personality of John Ford. He has a unique feel to the dialogue and the stamp and the framing of the film. And he works that tension between his own incestuous stuff. He clearly is working his own incest stuff out. And the struggle with this historical material in the narrative of the story itself. And I think a good auteur has that, and if a good artist has that, and they are not conscious at an analytic level and shouldn't be about the other things. They're just alive and vital and committed. Now, later on, my guess is he'd have all sorts of thoughts. But have any of you ever read the Francois Truffaut's series of interviews without Hitchcock? A famous set of interviews that you can get. I noticed now it's out in paper. If you read those interviews, Truffaut keeps trying to trick Hitchcock into telling the meaning of his films. And whenever that comes up, Hitchcock slips off the hook and does an interesting segue into talking about the problems of production and managing the cast. He never answers the question about what it means. I mean, you get a feeling he knows more than he's telling, but he's aware that maybe that's an individuating secret he needs to learn for himself, too. But when they do it, I think they're absorbed in the numinous of the experience. Very much like being in analysis. When you have a powerful dream, or you have a synchronistic experience, you don't sit around and think about what it means. You're just caught in the feeling and absorbed in the power and the implication and import for existence and the soul that's touched by it. I don't ask, what does this mean? I'm just overwhelmed by the experience itself. I think a lot of film creators do the same thing. One more.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.